Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Much has been said in the last few years about the American presidency and the people who have occupied it and might occupy it. We've had some real doozies in the office over the years, men who precipitated and prolonged constitutional crises. We get a thorough account in a new book. Corey Brettschneider is the author of The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. Corey Brettschneider teaches constitutional law and politics. He's a professor at Brown University in Rhode Island. His writing has appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post, among others, and in another book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Corey Brettschneider, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
My pleasure. Looking forward to the conversation.
You know, I'm going to take a wild guess. You probably would have written this book anyway, but I wonder if there's anything in recent history that sped up its production.
Well, I certainly was thinking about it during the Trump administration, and January 6th just furthered my thoughts that there's really something dangerous, not just about Trump, but about the American presidency. And I wanted to think more seriously, too, about the way that American history relates to the crisis of democracy that we're thinking about right now. And, you know, as I began to think and research and work on the book, of course, this became apparent that while there are unique things about Trump, including his coming back after the loss and continuing to threaten democracy well after he left office, that is different than any of the other presidents that I look at. The idea is that there's something in the structure of American democracy that makes the presidency dangerous, and that we've seen that danger emerge multiple times before Trump, five times specifically. And, you know, there's a warning that I talk about in the book from Patrick Henry, who said, really don't ratify this Constitution. We know him, of course, as the revolutionary hero, but less well known is that he was an opponent of ratification. And the reason was, he said, look, the presidency is so dangerous, it assumes a good person in office, and any checks and balances really rest on that assumption of a good person. But what if you get a criminal in office? A criminal president is how he talks about it. That person's going to realize that the checks are really few and far between until they actually get so emboldened that they crown themselves a monarch. He uses that word. And that might have seemed like paranoia, and that Henry was just off and misunderstood American democracy. But, I think there's something to it, that we're in a moment now that reveals the real vulnerability. American democracies survived before through citizens rising up, not through courts, not through Congress. And that saved us in the past, and I think it could happen again, too.
Well, Patrick Henry's words certainly illuminate my next question, which is to point out that your book went to bed before the Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity, and I wonder how much your jaw dropped at the breadth of that decision.
I wish I could say I was surprised. I think that, what it does is it really reinforces the argument of the end of the book, and a lot of commentators have picked up on this. A Boston Globe review, nice Boston Globe, talked about it as predicting the future, because what I say at the end of the book is that although we've recovered in the past from presidents who have threatened democracy by citizens really prevailing upon future presidents to put a democratic understanding of the Constitution back in place after authoritarian presidents and their understanding of the Constitution threatened to collapse American democracy, the last president that I talk about is Richard Nixon, the fifth president who threatened democracy discussed in the book. And my argument is we really haven't recovered from Nixon, that it is true that he was removed by the threat of impeachment. But what we failed to do was to really put back for all time the constraint on a president that would say a president is not above the law. And specifically, I talk about the grand jury that tried to indict him, some of them with two hands, as Elaine Edlund, one of the grand jurors who tried to indict Nixon, a legal secretary, puts it. She says, their argument was he committed a crime. It's pretty simple. People who commit crime should be tried and convicted. But that never happened. The pardon stopped that. And we still have a system in place that's informed largely by Nixonian ideas. They've been refined under the banner of the unitary executive that prioritize really the power of the president even above the law, making right now the vulnerability of the person looking into a president's wrongdoing fireable by that president. That's the core idea of the unitary executive, and then extended into this really dangerous idea that not only sitting presidents but former presidents are immune from prosecution. Those are all Nixonian ideas, and part of the book's point is that just as we've recovered from past crises, we've got to recover from this one, a crisis that really puts a president above the law, literally, as the Supreme Court's made clear.
Corey Brettschneider is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. So you mentioned one of the five presidents. The others are Adams, Buchanan, Andrew Johnson, and Woodrow Wilson. So those five people, and I probably a few people wondering already, why Andrew Jackson not in this bunch?
Well, I'm really looking not just at moments of presidents who had beliefs that were bad or who did things that were even evil, but at a specific kind of constitutional failure. Article 2 of the Constitution commits a president in the first seconds in office to committing to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And the argument of the book is that in these five instances, we had presidents who really threatened not just an aspect of the Constitution, but the entire constitutional system. And they did so by really interpreting the Constitution in a deeply undemocratic way, disregarding the idea of we, the people, in favor of an authoritarian idea of the Constitution that threatened democracy in a fundamental way. So, you know, there are other cases that we could have discussed, certainly terrible moments in American history that aren't the focus of the book, but this is about really assaults on some fundamental pillar, as I put it, of constitutional democracy in the United States. So when you look at the examples, you know, what John Adams did, and it's so underappreciated because of the attempt to really laud former presidents. Adams was one of the premier thinkers of his time, and he's celebrated for that. But his thoughts are dangerous ones. He really thought of the president as a kind of constitutional monarch. And more than that, signed the Sedition Act and had his attorney general wield it to try to shut down the opposition party. And, you know, that would have really meant that we didn't have anything resembling American democracy. Multi-party democracy isn't just a part of the system. It is the system. The denial, as President Buchanan sought, of all rights, literally all rights to Black Americans, lobbying the Supreme Court successfully to describe the Dred Scott case, is also a systemic assault on the very idea that we have rights under law. And I would say the same, too, for Johnson and Wilson's attempt to create a system of second-class citizenship, Wilson nationalizing the idea of white supremacy well beyond the regionalism that had previously been thought to accompany it and to try to both simultaneously grow the federal government, but in a way that spread the idea institutionally of white supremacy, partly through the segregation of the increasingly large federal government, but also importantly culturally through not just showing Birth of a Nation in the White House, but supporting the view of it and the ideology of it, which is also informed in his lecture notes at Princeton as a constitutional law professor, in which he really argued that friction, which he meant integration, was the chief danger to the thriving of American democracy. And in the case of Nixon, it was, like Adams, an attempt to shut down opposition. We focus so much on Watergate, but really what Nixon did was organize a criminal unit in the White House to go after political opponents, including Daniel Ellsberg, who I interviewed at the end of his life about this and about the threats, including the attempt to kill him, incapacitate him on the Capitol steps, crimes that were being investigated by the prosecutors looking into Nixon's crimes and wiped away by the pardon. So these aren't just incidents that are horrible or even evil, they are systemic attacks on the idea of American democracy.
Corey Brettschneider, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. I want to go back to John Adams for just a second and his extreme dislike of any kind of dissent and wanting to lock people up, shut down their newspapers, etc. The country was only 20 years removed from a king. I mean, was there support for Adams' position?
Yes. And, you know, the country, part of the idea of the book is that the ideas of democracy really weren't settled. And there were ideological, theoretical defenses of authoritarianism, including Adams that were widespread. In particular, his party, the Federalist Party, believed that the Sedition Act was constitutional and disregarded the newly passed First Amendment, including its guarantee of free speech, as compatible essentially with a kind of monarchy. And the resistance to that idea, the idea that we think of now as so fundamental to our Constitution, that there's a right to dissent, a right to criticize a president, came from the newspaper editors who resisted Adams, who used their own trials to try to defeat authoritarianism, and eventually from the uptake of those editors in the election of 1800 by Thomas Jefferson, who in the moment really proclaiming constitutional recovery from Adams said, famously, we're all Republicans, we're all Federalists, we're all Republicans. And the idea was there is going to be a right to dissent. I'm not going to shut down the opposition party. We will have multi-party democracy in the United States. These recoveries, of course, never come from the Supreme Court, and that's continuous with the decision that we've seen now. In fact, the court often makes things worse. And in the case of Adams, the Supreme Court, far from stopping him, really believed in what he was doing. Samuel Chase, one of the justices, lobbied for the Sedition Act. And just to show you how, as you put it, how bold it was in trying to shut down the opposition, the Sedition Act made it a crime to criticize the President of the United States, but it didn't make it a crime to criticize the Vice President of the United States, who, of course, was a member of a different party, Thomas Jefferson at the time. So this was really an act designed to shut down the opposition, and it had wide support among not just those in the executive branch, but by the Supreme Court itself.
So I have to ask at this point, the power of the executive, I mean, do you think it's a bug or a feature of the Constitution?
It can be both. I mean, I think that's the what American history shows. It's certainly a danger, and it has to be constrained, and there should be ways of organizing it in a way. For instance, getting rid of this immunity decision is crucial to rein it in. Left unchecked, the way that it is now, if a bad person, or as Henry said, I'll put it in his terms, a criminal president, were to get into office, there really aren't checks in the way that he said on the destruction of the entire system. So the presidency itself is certainly a threat, a danger in the hands of a president who lacks, as the framers would have called it, virtues, thinking about the public good. But on the other hand, when I look at American history, the moments of recovery, which the book is equally focused on, are moments in which citizens prevailed on presidents who would listen to them and who would kind of use the power of the office to put back the fundamental pillars of democracy. So I mentioned Jefferson, and I'll add Madison too, his ally during the War of 1812, you know, knowing what had happened during Adams, and the pushback from the editors, when there were calls, even from his own party, within his own party, for a new Sedition Act, he resisted. Or the story of Lincoln being prevailed upon by Frederick Douglass to really change from a view that saw slavery as immoral, but still legal, certainly within the states, to urging him to turn the war not just into a war for union, but a war against slavery. That change of mind, which then, of course, impacts all of American history, shows the power of a president who is willing to be responsive to the democratic ideas that often come from the citizenry. And I'll mention, too, Harry Truman, who's really chosen to replace a vice president by FDR, who's seen as too liberal, and is assured, the Democratic Party is assured that this is a racist who uses the N-word. But Truman, once he's in office and is prevailed upon by the NAACP, told the stories of soldiers returning from war who are being beaten in the American South, certainly because of their race, really opens himself to be convinced to lead and to set an agenda for a second Reconstruction, a new civil rights movement. And unknown people played such a huge role there, people like the hero Sadie Alexander, who is should be known as widely as some of these other figures and is not. So the presidency is a danger, and these presidents who threaten democracy show it. But it also, there is a potential for the idea of the virtue of the office, of restoring American democracy.
Our guest is Corey Brettschneider, who is a professor at Brown University teaching constitutional law and politics. His book is The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. And the presidents are Adams, James Buchanan, Andrew Johnson, Woodrow Wilson, and Richard Nixon. So the binary you're pointing out in the book, as we've gotten to so far, Corey, is that there's this office that has a lot of power, yes, but it's also within the power of the people to resist it, which then pops a question into my head. So when an authoritarian has the support of the people, we could be in real trouble.
Absolutely. Those are the most dangerous moments. There's nothing about the people that inherently means that they are going to resist authoritarianism. And as populist presidents like Woodrow Wilson, I'll say a little bit more about that, have shown, that the support of the people can be used for really illegitimate ends. There are different theories of authoritarianism. For Adams, it really was this sort of analogy with monarchy that he thought gave him the power to shut down dissent. But the kind of authoritarianism that Woodrow Wilson used was different. He really reinvented the presidency. He used the bully pulpit, which was famously the term coined, and bully, by the way, meaning neato, not bully like, right. With the stick, Theodore Roosevelt had created the press office. He uses that to try to recreate the presidency as a kind of populist office. And his idea is that really the president is an equal among the other branches. He's the first among equals. So what does he use this new kind of power of communication to do? As I said, he segregates the federal government. He not only shows Birth of a Nation in the White House, but as I said, the film itself reflects arguments and a history that he had used in his textbook that criticized the Ku Klux Klan, but really talked about them as a necessary evil in the way that the film represents it. So as he's spreading these ideas of white supremacy, he's also creating this new, even more powerful office. Where does that power come from? He says, look, the president is the only person elected by all the American people, and so the president has this unique kind of power. And to the extent that he's drawing power from Southern white supremacists in doing that, there's a real danger. Of course, some of the supporters of Donald Trump, including the Oath Keepers during January 6th, try to, you know, use popular support to justify authoritarianism. So there's nothing about mass movements themselves that are inherently good. But if we think about the moments in which American democracy has been recovered, it is the result of very different kinds of movements, not those that just simply seek to aggrandize the power of one president or one person, but those that try to restore the pillars of democracy, the idea, and I'll just say what they are. In the first instance, the first crisis, the fight over the right to dissent. In the second crisis, the fight over legal personhood and equal citizenship. And in the third crisis stoked by Wilson, the fight over second-class citizenship. The final crisis, the one that I'm suggesting we're still in, is about the very idea that we're ruled by laws, not by an individual person, or the rule of law, as we often talk about it. That's the idea that Nixon resisted, and that we need a new citizens movement to try to bring back. And of course, there's a counter movement. The Trumpism is the opposite, I think, of that idea.
I wonder how much the American people contribute to this. You do point out that it's the American people who restored order after most of these crises, the Democratic constitutional constituencies, you call them. But I wonder how much the American people in general, in thinking of the president as something like a king, contribute to this. You know how people always say, well, FDR did this, Nixon did that, Truman did that. And often it's the Congresses that did that, and these presidents signed it. Now, maybe Congress did it at the urging of those presidents, but we still think in terms of this guy did those things.
That's a really brilliant point, brilliant question, and brings out what I hope will be shown by the book, which is that, you know, there are people who think about the presidency that way. And unfortunately, a lot of the history of the American presidents has celebrated these individuals as sort of great leaders, which is actually a word ironically coined by Wilson as the one who really talked about the president as a leader. And it creates a kind of cult of personality. That's one of the dangers of our system of government, the presidential system, And I'm trying to give a very different idea of what a virtuous president looks like. It's not just somebody who acts in a quote-unquote great way. It's someone who respects the idea that the president is part of a wider democratic system, part of a republic, the phrase the framers used for representative government, and that that person is bound by the rule of law, bound by the idea of a right to dissent. And as thanks to the contribution of Frederick Douglass, who I think of as really the true founder of American democracy, that they also need to see that the ideas in the 13th Amendment ending slavery and the badges and incidents of slavery, ending the 14th Amendment proclaiming equal protection of law, and the 15th Amendment proclaiming a right to vote regardless of race, that those are part of American democracy too, that the Constitution requires a multiracial democracy. Presidents devoted to those pillars, they are fulfilling the oath of office that I talked about in Article 2 to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And presidents who are just out for their own power or some generic idea of leadership really don't capture that.
We're talking to Corey Brettschneider on the Jefferson Exchange about his book, The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. I want to go back and pick up some particular points here in the history. So more concrete than some of the abstraction we've been dealing with for a little bit now. But the views of the Constitution itself, William Lloyd Garrison, this is a really interesting thing I didn't know before this book, and what his view was on what the pathway to eliminate slavery would be.
Right. You know, throughout American history, as these crises deepen, there's an understandable response, and it's one that I hear a lot now, and it's part of my motivation in writing the book. It's like, this thing is terrible, this thing being the Constitution. Let's scrap it. And nowhere was that view more dramatically illustrated than by the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison. And what Garrison said was that this is a pro-slavery document that was tainted from the beginning. It's a kind of pact with the devil and, you know, a contract with hell. He had a lot of imagery like that. Let's destroy it and start again. And Frederick Douglass, although at first being an acolyte of Garrison, breaks with him on this issue, and this book is really in the vein of Douglass's argument. And he says, look, if you read the Constitution in this narrow way, of course, you can see terrible things in it, Exhibit A being its complicity with slavery. But if you read it for the broad principles, you see, first of all, the term enslavement or slavery is never mentioned. And then you also see the broad principles that are enshrined in the document. So let's take the most important one for the purposes of the book. The preamble, this is Douglass's argument, Frederick Douglass's argument. It says, we the people. It doesn't say we the white people. When you look at the ban on the idea that you inherit the sins of the parents, the ban on the corruption of blood and the related ban on bills of attainder, that what those provisions do is they create a set of democratic principles, and that's the thing that we should have fidelity to. And that's the true meaning of the Constitution. And so in doing so, Douglass is both preserving the framers' Constitution, but also re-explaining it to us as a reader, as a democratic document. And that's why, to me, his argument is so much more powerful than Garrison's. His legacy is so much more powerful because he really is showing how to use the power of our American Constitution to further the ends of democracy and bring us into the future. And Garrison is his argument, and he is largely forgotten compared to Douglass, who should be even more celebrated because once you understand the role that he played, which was really to refound American democracy, he certainly is as important. In fact, I'd argue more important than any 18th century founder.
So it's a really interesting part of the book. There aren't any uninteresting parts, I should point out. But I do want to come back to one particular point about that period in history, which is James Buchanan, of course, the president just before Lincoln, who said, hey, a federal government doesn't have any power. I can't do anything about slavery. Sorry. But you talked about him being involved in the Dred Scott decision. How?
Right. I mean, he's different than Adams, who really kind of is telling you in his writings what he thinks. But Buchanan is publicly proclaiming a kind of neutrality and saying, really, on the slavery issue, the Supreme Court's got this big case coming up. Let's just let them decide. But secretly, he's doing something very different. He's really lobbying the Supreme Court for the extreme decision that comes, that essentially claims that Black Americans have no rights under the federal constitution, that they aren't even citizens, as I put it, they aren't even legal persons. And he's doing that in secret while lying to the American public in speeches, including in his inaugural address. And Frederick Douglass and others, you know what he's up to. They're calling him out, and they see this fake neutrality, as I call it, for what it is. So it is a different, you know, different way than Nixon and Adams in threatening democracy. It's using this language of, you know, balls and strikes, really, neutrality, to hide a more sinister agenda. And, you know, the phrase balls and strikes, of course, was used by John Roberts to defend the Supreme Court. And, you know, I think that Buchanan's claim to neutrality was as bogus as Roberts' own.
Yeah, Roberts never mentioned exactly where the strike zone would be and how much it would be enlarged. different conversation for a different day. Another specific point in a specific presidency, and Wilson and the level of his belief in white supremacy is just fully appreciated in this book. And I began to wonder about cause and effect. I mean, did Birth of the Nation get created by D.W. Griffith on screen because of Wilson?
Well, I'll give you the facts, and then we could figure out how strongly we want to state it. The Birth of a Nation is based on a book called The Klansman, and the author of The Klansman was a colleague and friend of Wilson from Johns Hopkins, where Wilson completed his PhD. So it's a much bigger connection than just that he showed this film. It goes to, you know, the author of the book that it's about. And then what I do in the book is I really read Wilson. Was a popular author. He was one of the premier constitutional thinkers of his time, professor at Princeton later. He was also president, of course, of Princeton, and he authored American History, a textbook. And when you read the book and you see the images of the film, there certainly are parallels. Did the film influence the book, which then influenced the movie? I'll let readers decide, but the parallels are certainly very close. And, of course, the book, you know, well predates the film, but as significant, and that's important culturally because it shows you why he had such affinity for this film and why he promoted it. But, you know, it's also in his lecture notes. What I did was I went into the archives at Princeton University where the librarians had preserved the notes that the students had taken in his classes, writing down what he said. And he says things in there like that the postbellum amendments, the 15th Amendment, for instance, didn't add rights to the Constitution, that they just left state sovereignty in place. They didn't do anything. And for a constitutional scholar, you know, the great accomplishment of Douglas of Reconstruction were those three amendments that we still rely on for the ideas of equal protection and banning the badges in incidents of slavery and a right to vote free from racial discrimination. And he just disparages them in the lectures. And this idea, too, that he celebrates of being efficiency and thinking about the Constitution as efficient and tying that to the idea of resisting friction, by which he means integration. You see that not just in the notes, but when Trotter confronts him, it's not that people didn't realize what was going on. William Monroe Trotter, the great journalist and very early civil rights activist, confronts him. And what does he say? He says, you know, you're creating friction, essentially. Wow. So the views of white supremacy are very deep in Wilson. They're philosophical. They're in his lectures and in his textbooks, certainly, as well.
It's an amazing book, which is detailed and frequently grim, but also somewhat breezy. The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It, by Corey Brettschneider. Corey, thanks for sharing this with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks. What a great discussion. Thank you for reading the book in such depth. I really appreciate it.